The future began 75 years ago with the invention of something small, considered the most manufactured item in human history and the biggest thing since fire. I'm David Brancaccio. Welcome to a Marketplace podcast special, one episode under a half hour of your time. The transistor was born in New Jersey on December 16, 1947. I often bike from my house right past where they got the first one to work. Yet that facility is set back from the road, Mountain Avenue, and it had never really caught my eye. What was that copper-roofed campus? A community college? Another pharmaceutical headquarters we have out here? It turned out to be something completely different. And as I dove into some research, it rekindled my interest in the ingredients needed for places that become hotspots for invention. This at a time when so many places want to be one. Transistors defined the last half of the 20th century and nearly the first quarter of the century we live in now. Odds are they've got you surrounded. For proof of that, let's start in my kitchen. Looky here, something with an on-off switch that does not contain transistors, a hand-pump espresso maker from the late 70s, versus everything else.
Getting Marketplace Morning Report from Amazon Music. Continuing the latest episode, what China's
The smart speaker has transistors in the billions. They're part of the oven, microwave, fridge, a clock with outside temperature, even the darn toaster and car keys. This transistor infestation and our electronic and information world owes a debt to a team of physicists that faced grinding years of false starts to get the first transistor to work 75 years ago this week.
This circuit was actually spoken over, and by switching the device in and out, a distinct gain in speech level could be heard and seen on the scope presentation with no noticeable change in quality.
That is physicist Walter Bratton in a vintage industrial film reading his original notes aloud about the demonstration he did with his lab partner John Bardeen to show their bosses. It was a contraption using a shard of rock, germanium, an element that's not an electrical conductor like copper or an insulator like rubber, but in between. Ready for the word? It is a semiconductor.
It has enabled this global civilization that we are experiencing.
Michael Riordan is a physicist and science historian and co-author with Lillian Hodison of Crystal Fire, the invention of the transistor and the birth of the information age. Within weeks, Bratton and Bardeen's supervisor, William Shockley, rushed to think up an improved, easier-to-manufacture version. All three would win the Nobel Prize.
I would put it on the level as fire, in terms of its importance to what modern life is like today.
There's almost a magic to this thing. No moving parts. If you don't have germanium, you can make it from sand. It shrinks and still works.
And I think it's one of the main reasons the United States was first to get to the moon. The Soviet Union did not have a microchip industry in the 1960s.
So more than the wheel or the printing press. But what is a transistor? Well, at first, two things: a tiny switch, like the flipper on a pinball game. When the ball comes rolling, that's the signal, the transistor can let it through or flip it away, open or closed, a zero or a one, the essence of what would be the digital revolution. A transistor is also a kind of cattle prod, which gooses a signal along so that it's louder. If engineers could figure out how to make these en masse, they could replace the bulky, fragile glass tubes that heated up the insides of earlier electronics. What follows is digital everything. Watching movies on your mobile phone, e-commerce, the collapse of newspapers, social media addiction. But I'm getting ahead of myself. To explore ecosystems of innovation, let's start with what was regarded as a kind of U.S. national laboratory run by a private corporation.
The transistor lab did not look like this, but it was physically in this area.
It happens through a door to what is now a laboratory clean room in Section 1E of this research campus in New Jersey.
So here it is, just feet from the spot where they got the first transistor to work. Here, let me just absorb the vibe.
The physicists who wiggled their little rig just right in there were employed by the phone company, back when you said it that way, the phone company, mother of them all, Ma Bell AT&T. Bell Telephone Laboratories had the resources to produce the solar cell, the laser, the CCD camera on a chip, the cellular phone system, and the transistor. Just how has something to do with the phone bills your parents and grandparents were paying? Those monthly phone bills once funded, really funded, this complex of laboratories where the little critter came to life 75 years ago.
So first of all, Murray Hill is the headquarters for Bell Laboratories.
That first prototype looks like a praying mantis perched on a guitar pick, and you'll be pleased to know I didn't drop it.
I have to wear protective gloves, but I'm actually right now holding in my hand the first transistor. A cockeyed metal spring pushing a kind of arrowhead wrapped in gold foil down into a shard of germanium, the semiconductor, all that on top of a metal base.
On this campus in Jersey, 45 minutes west of Manhattan, researchers on the payroll of a private company figured out how to make an amplifier that didn't need much power and an on-off switch with no moving parts. This fundamental invention gets us to portable and digital everything. It was called Bell Telephone Laboratories, the research arm of AT&T. At its height, boy, did it have money, because it was a company with no rival. Physicist Michael Reardon is co-author of the history of the transistor, Crystal Fire.
Bell Labs was kind of like a national laboratory in a way, but it was funded by the American people. I'm old enough to remember when we had to pay a dollar for the first minute of a coast-to-coast telephone call called a toll call. And 3 cents out of that dollar went into R&D, mainly at Bell Labs. So it had the stream of funding and gave them a lot of freedom to follow, you know, their research noses.
Yeah, I mean, being a lab that's connected to a monopoly affords you certain privileges.
That second voice is John Gertner, author of The Idea Factory, Bell Labs in the Great Age of American Innovation.
So the timelines are sort of different. I mean, do you have to beat the competition to market? Not really. Can you work on a system for switching or transmission that might take 10 years or 15 years? Yes, you can, actually.
100 years ago, AT&T was the biggest company in the world and rich enough to scoop up talent even during lean times.
Bell Labs had money to hire people in the Great Depression at a time when a lot of universities did not, and a lot of companies did not. Brilliant scientists where Bell Labs could really hire the best and brightest.
Like physicists John Bardeen, Walter Bratton, and William Shockley, who shared a Nobel Prize for the transistor in 1956. 9 Nobels trace here. Ed Eckert is archivist at the present Bell Labs as he looks over original homegrown artifacts.
The cellular concept made cell phones practical. Commercial fax machine. Satellite pioneer with Telstar 1, solar cells, the science of radio astronomy. And we discovered the leftover radiation that was considered proof of the Big Bang theory.
Bell Labs survived the court-ordered breakup of the AT&T monopoly in 1984, and some of its culture lives on. These days, it's one of the research centers owned since 2016 by Nokia of Finland. Peter Vetter is president of Nokia Bell Labs Core Research, where even today there's room for raw exploration.
When a researcher comes to me, I have here an intuition that there is a new way of solving the problem, that they can go after that and say, okay, this sounds good. We put them in contact with different experts, the device physics people, some AI algorithmic people, so that they can really enrich the idea.
With wireless, about every 10 years, it's a new G, and Vetter's folks are now working on 6G, plus crazy fast quantum computing, and a new, not-so-small step for mankind, the first
cellular network on the moon.
This is Nokia, but you may well ask why the Bell Lab transistor didn't turn AT&T in the 1950s and 60s into another IBM or Sony. We'll see, even decades before AT&T's breakup, officials in Washington didn't want a monopoly phone company nosing into other businesses, like computers.
They were sort of bound by various agreements with the federal government that they were in the telecommunications business.
So Bell Labs' parent company more or less open-sourced the transistor, not for free, but it sold licenses to other companies for not much and trained them in the theory. This allowed transistor technology to travel to Texas for it to become music to our ears.
Time, weather, and
Before there was the first iPod, before the Walkman, there was this handy music player.
Hello, hello again. Shaboom and hum, we'll meet again.
A radio with transistors, not vacuum tubes. The first one was the Regency TR-1, and on its launch just before Christmas, 1954, was priced at $50, about $550 in today's money.
What was amazing was that people were so transfixed with it that it sold out at that price. They couldn't make enough of them at first.
That's Don Pease, son of the co-founder of the Regency Company of Indianapolis. The design looked good enough to eat. Multiple colors, big brassy dial. They didn't sound great, but you could take them to the game or to the beach. Regency made these at the invitation of a Dallas firm, which had just started manufacturing the four transistors inside.
Because that would show that, yes, the transistor is a practical device.
And how did Texas Instruments, TI, in Dallas get into transistors, patented by Bell Labs in New Jersey 4 years earlier? Well, they bought a cheap license from Ma Bell, AT&T, for just $300,000 in today's money. And something else, a guy named Gordon Teal, who'd been working on a new kind of transistor, the first ones with silicon. Here's David Laws, a curator at the Computer History Museum in California.
Bell didn't pursue that very much because they didn't need the real benefit of silicon, which was the ability to operate over much wider temperature ranges. The first commercial silicon transistor was a great success for TI because now military equipment could begin to use transistors.
The company had roots in electronics for oil exploration, but a new TI boss saw this work as too cyclical, says Max Post, a longtime TI employee.
There was so much volatility in both the petroleum market up and down on exploration, and also military contracts were not very stable in those days. He persuaded the company to let's get into manufacturing.
That visionary boss, Pat Haggerty, came to Dallas in 1945 after buying technology for the Pentagon during the war, where he'd seen that vacuum tubes had to go. He would build a company with the culture to become a mini Bell Labs.
They gave you the chance for failure. They'd let you explore ideas, and there was no penalty for failure in those days.
This culture attracted an engineer in 1958 named Jack Kilby, who had a passion for jamming circuits into smaller spaces for important stuff like hearing aids. A rival firm nearly hired him, but stipulated he could only do the work with part of his time. Instead, TI's boss said Kilby could focus on what he wanted.
He said, you may work on that full time and see what comes out of it.
At TI, Kilby then co-invents the integrated circuit, a way to put transistors and other components on a chip without a rat's nest of wires. He wins the Nobel Prize. The pocket calculator is also partly his invention. And that first pocket radio his company promoted as a transistor marketing tool, 150,000 are sold. Not bad, but the platinum mega hit goes to another outfit that bought a transistor license from Bell Labs, Tokyo Tsushin Kogyo, which starts a more familiar brand. Again, curator David Laws.
That was the great success of Sony, was to start building transistor radios at very low cost and in high volume. And it eventually swept the market, of course.
It's the start of the shift of transistor production overseas, which eventually leads to a big U.S.-Japan trade conflict in the 1980s. Later, most semiconductor fabrication migrates across Asia, something Congress and the Biden administration now are trying to address with the $280 billion CHIPS Act. But before all of that, the microprocessor, the little brains on a chip with billions and billions of transistors, has to be invented. This happens not at Bell or Dallas, but in apricot orchards out west. The southwest corner of the San Francisco Bay is where the Silicon Revolution blossoms. Why there, of all places?
Because his mother lived there, is one of the answers.
He's coming home, yeah.
Right, and he's on a lookout for what he called hot mines, and he brings them all there.
a tech curator, an author, and a historian talking about why William Shockley, one of the Nobel Prize winners for the transistor, moved from New Jersey to California's Santa Clara Valley to be closer to his mother and to start a transistor factory. There are other reasons. Leslie Berlin, the historian, is author of Troublemakers, Silicon Valley's Coming of Age.
Okay, I will throw out universities, Stanford and Berkeley across the bay.
Well, what are some of the other ingredients in the Silicon Valley mix?
You've got the presence of the Department of Defense in the form of Moffett Field. And this becomes vitally important because the only place that can afford to buy transistors early on is the Department of Defense.
I suppose the weather is nice out there, but there's some cultural aspects there. Like you can try something, it may not work out, but your name is not mud at that point. You might get a second chance.
It was a place for risk takers. And the way you can see that most clearly is that nearly everybody came from somewhere else.
And it's got funders who also embrace risk. David Laws is semiconductor curator at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California.
Just the ability to borrow money once you've flushed venture capital money away without success. If they saw and understood the reasons why it wasn't successful, then they'll take a risk with you. That won't happen in many parts of the world.
I think it can't be underestimated the importance of William Shockley himself showing up and being able to attract the hottest minds.
Shockley, as Gordon Moore said one time, was so brilliant he could see electrons. But he was very egotistical, wanted the glory for himself. And the style of management he used just really upset all these young new grads he'd hired. And so they decided to seek fame and fortune elsewhere.
This not-so-quiet quitting of eight people at once, the traitorous eight, in Shockley's view, is a turning point in the Valley, the dawn of startup culture. In search of a new gig as a group, one of the eight calls his father's stockbroker. And here's the advice.
What you really ought to do is set up your own company, and we will find funding for you.
The Gordon Moore, speaking with the Electrochemical Society in 2016. Dude's got a law named after him. Moore's Law foresaw that transistors on a chip would double every year for decades. And that stockbroker, well, he finds venture money from a camera company back east for the traders, which becomes Fairchild Semiconductor, where Laws, the curator, used to work.
The combination of venture capital, the fact that many companies spun out of Fairchild, all the resources in terms of supplies of equipment and other services just created a whole ecosystem that was very receptive to the growth of new companies.
Out of this nucleus comes Intel, with a market value today of $120 billion. Moore is co-founder. Another of the eight, Robert Noyce, one of the two inventors of the integrated circuit, becomes CEO. Shockley never does get especially rich from his transistor. In 1982, he runs for governor of California, pushing a platform that embraces the racist view of eugenics. He loses. And note that out of that group of eight who left Shockley, all but Moore were new to California, and two were international immigrants, including Jean Arnie, who devises the process that revolutionizes chip manufacturing. He's from Switzerland.
And this continues to be a key to Silicon Valley's success in the form of immigrants who are new to the country coming now. And back then, it was immigrants who were new to this specific part of the country.
And back at Bell Labs, two other immigrants, one from Egypt, one from Korea, were to invent the kind of transistor we're most likely to use now. There are 16 billion of that variety in the latest iPhone model now. And a half century ago, you could find some in a path-breaking but elusive desktop calculator.
I've been hoping for a long time that somebody would find a 141PF sitting in their closet gathering dust and go, hey, you know, do you want this thing?
Rick Benson, an IT guy in Oregon, owns a lot of vintage units as founder of the Old Calculator Web Museum. Anyone got one called the Bizicom 141? He'll pay for shipping.
It's a 141PF, which is the special one. That became the very first consumer item to be produced that utilized a computer on a chip. They're very hard to find today.
This calculator was marketed by a Japanese company, but its brain was devised in California in 1971. That brain is the first commercial microprocessor. It was developed at Intel by a guy from Rochester, New York, Ted Hoff, and a fellow from Vicenza, Italy, Federico Fagin, assisted by Masatoshi Shima of Japan. Embedded in that were 2,000 transistors that were innovations in themselves. They used a sandwich technique, something devised years earlier at, it keeps showing up in this project, Bell Labs in New Jersey.
The MOSFET is really the technology that makes what we could say Moore's Law possible, the possibility of continual growth in the number of transistors we put on an integrated circuit.
Ross Bassett is a professor of history at North Carolina State University. The development of electronics in the U.S. features many immigrants from Europe. Alexander Graham Bell, the phone's inventor, was from Scotland. Nikola Tesla's from what is now Croatia. And the two researchers who chose an unconventional path to improve the transistor were Mohammed John Atala, raised in Egypt, and Dawan Kong from Korea.
Atala and Kong were from what we would now call the Global South, and they were drawn to the United States by American graduate education in engineering. And so that was sort of the magnet that brought them to the United States.
Dr. Bassett was able to meet Dr. Atala late in the inventor's life.
One of the things that was interesting about Atala is that he refused to limit himself to a discipline. He called himself a problem solver. He worked on the MOS transistor. Then he moved out to Silicon Valley and worked for a branch of Hewlett-Packard. And then he finally started his own company, which was involved in cryptography.
Another Atala invention, the ATM pin code. To research the intersection of immigration and innovation, Jennifer Hunt, a professor of economics at Rutgers University, counts up patents.
Immigrants patented about twice the native-born rate.
She says one reason is because more skilled immigrants come to the U.S. with the kind of experience that lends itself to invention, compared to, say, a law degree from overseas.
Whereas physical sciences and engineering, at least in their pure form, completely portable.
And research shows when skilled immigrants are part of the mix, patents by U.S. native-born researchers also rise. Everyone gets more motivated in some way.
It seems likely that working in teams, for example, of native-born workers and immigrant workers tends to lead to a better outcome than if there had been no immigrants in the teams.
As for that foreign pipeline of talent, the number of graduate students studying in the U.S. from Asia, including India, has now rebounded from its pandemic trough, 284,000 in the last academic year. But with tech stocks sagging, some skilled immigrant workers may leave for other countries as visas expire. Longer term, semiconductor work in the U.S. is set to boom with new federal funding, fueled by national security and supply chain worries. It's $280 billion to bring back to the U.S. the production of microchips slathered in transistors invented 75 years ago. Semiconductors changed everything, but you may have noticed they did not solve everything. I'm left with new questions. For example, how does the bounty that comes with innovation get spread to more people? How can new ecosystems of innovation decrease inequality instead of widening gaps? Can these ecosystems become engines for both profit and the public good? How can we increase the chances innovation addresses our most pressing problems? These are just some of the topics we hope to explore on Marketplace in the new year. The Future Began 75 Years Ago was produced by Alex Schroeder, with Erica Soderstrom and Jarrett Dang. Our editor was Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. Our digital producer was Redmond Caralipio. Audio engineers were Gary O'Keefe, Jake Cherry, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Juan Carlos Torrado. The general manager of Marketplace is Neil Scarborough. I'm David Brancaccio.
a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.